This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantal Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting WindroseRecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Priya Veer, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Deep in the Santa Monica Mountains, Her Escape Vortex offers a unique and truly fantastic setting for your next spiritual retreat. The Lavender Garden, the fire pit overlooking the Topanga Canyon sunset, and the Moroccan-furnished yurt on this magical property provide the atmosphere for an inspiring and transformative experience. A sacred place ideal for yoga and wellness retreats, as well as cleansing and healing ceremony of all kinds, Her Escape Vortex is part of a community of people eager for personal and spiritual growth. Visit thepathtoauthenticity.com/her-escape-vortex or click on the link in the show notes for more information.
Hi, authentic listener. My name's Lane Kennedy. I'm the host of Recover Like a Mother, a podcast dedicated to calm living. It's also dedicated to mothers in recovery. I want to invite you to episode 24. Yes, a very special episode, 24. It's a meditation created to get you aligned with your inner resource. And I know you're not here to do that today, to get aligned with your inner resource. You're here to connect and to listen to my friend and your host, Tom Gentry. Tom is an incredible human being, and he has this uncanny ability to connect with others. And that is why he and I are such good friends. I'm so fortunate to be able to share the podcasting space with him and so grateful that we have the opportunity to share with you. So enjoy his show, The Path to Authenticity. Come on over and listen to Recover Like a Mother when you have time. Take good care.
If this is your first time here, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 132 with Priya Veer. So, been working on giving the podcast a little bit of a facelift. You'll notice the artwork for this episode is different than those before. Looking at making my Instagram feed a little more aesthetically pleasing and hope to maybe get a little more traffic, attract more people to this show. I've tended to kind of treat it like a bulletin board or a journal instead of a tool to connect with people and engage people. And after a conversation with my friend Jen Conway, who took a lot of the photography for the podcast, all the stock photography for both of my websites, the cover art for the podcast, a lot of the art that I use are her incredible photos, and she's been a good friend for a long time, like 30 years. But she made me realize that it'd be good if I step it up a little bit. And also recently, with our last guest, Tanner Campbell, I had a conversation about future plans, things I have in the works. And he made a couple suggestions to me, and one of them was to try out a new program. So have some cool audiograms that I've been creating, sharing, just trying to kind of kick it up a notch. For this episode, a lot of these things I would ordinarily do later, but this time I had the transcript done before the episode, so that's going to be released around the same time as the episode. I had the audiogram done to promote the episode a few days ahead of time. I did an Instagram post with a quote from this episode that I'm going to post here before the episode releases or on the day of its release. I'm not sure yet. And I updated the cover art. And a couple of these things Jen actually did for me to look a little more sleek and clean. And I just kind of went with that. So hopefully it'll draw some more people to the show. And if you've listened, you've heard me mention at times how having a show about personal authenticity really requires me to show up in an authentic way and challenges me to do that, to kind of push my limits, step outside my comfort zone. It's, not always what I want, but sometimes it's what I need, whether I want it or not. So I send out something to each guest ahead of time, the 20 questions. And one of those questions is, what is something that you've struggled with consistently throughout the course of your life? And since I began asking that question, I've always known what the answer is for me. Quite honestly, it could be a couple things, but my relationship with money is something that has been challenging, painful, and it's not something that I like to talk about. So Priya does a podcast basically on financial literacy. She seeks to empower women in this part of their lives. And so when I encountered her on Clubhouse, I thought right away, I want to get her on the show because I know that's an area of my life that can be an obstacle for me in being everything I can be and everything I want to be. I know that I'm not the only one. I know other people out there struggle with the same thing. It's pretty common in our culture, yet it's something I don't like to talk about. Priya and I get into all that in this episode. So I met her on Clubhouse in a club for podcasters and reached out to her, and we talked on the same day. The last several guests I've had, I interviewed on Clubhouse, but I want to say that part of the goal for me in doing this show all along has been to connect with you. So there's a link in the show notes for my profile on Clubhouse, the Path to Authenticity Club on Clubhouse, and something I did last night, and I'm going to do at least for the month of July, see how it goes. I'm going to, on Friday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, do what I call the podcast Green Room. And that will be just me being available on Clubhouse. So if you want to connect, we can talk. It's a great way to connect with people. It's a great way to get to know people. Give it a shot. If you're skeptical about another social media platform, just give it a shot. You don't have to talk. You can just listen. For me, it took a little while to get comfortable with it, but, I've really connected with a lot of people on this platform, people who I would be friends with in the real world outside. If I met them, we would become friends. So I really appreciate it. I was skeptical myself, but again, if you're part of this community, I want to connect with you. So that's a good way to do it. Hop on. Let's talk. So I hope you enjoy this episode. I appreciate you listening. So here we go. Priya Veer.
Thank you.
So I know that you work in the financial sector. One of the things about the show, I like to really talk to people who I know are genuine, authentic, or else people who help the rest of us become increasingly authentic. And one of the things that can get in our way of being our most authentic selves, for some of us, are our relationships with money. Things like self-limiting beliefs around money. So I wanted to maybe touch on that a little bit, but also just to hear about you and what you do. So why don't you tell everybody what you do exactly?
Sure. So by sort of profession, I'm a technical consultant and a fintech specialist. And so normally I work for sort of consulting companies and work hired by financial institutions. I work up in Toronto, Canada. So normally our clients are always banks. And what we're doing for them is sort of streamlining processes, making things more efficient, whether that's from a data aggregation perspective, whether that's from a compliance perspective, making them more compliant, using sort of AI capabilities and machine learning technology. So a lot of the consulting companies I've worked for in the past, we have sort of built our own tech in-house that we then sort of deploy to FIs. So that's sort of my day job. Other things that I'm involved in, I also have a sort of family foundation that I've started with my husband in Toronto, and we basically support very grassroots organizations in Toronto that are doing real impactful work. Just with sort of this last year of us being in COVID, I think that we made a big strategic decision that we were going to give to sort of food insecurity just because of the amount of people that were on here. We call it CERB, which was the government assistance, because I don't know if people know, but like, you know, Toronto in North America has had one of the longest lockdowns in any city, I think even in the world. So there's been a lot of people that have been affected. So that's sort of where our charitable donation went last year. In addition to that, I do have a podcast called Her Story, Her Way, which is a platform to promote financial literacy and liberation for women around money management. And I'm having a lot of fun with that. And I think we'll get into it a little bit more about people's relationships with money, because I don't think enough people sort of stop to ask themselves, what is their relationship with money? Because I think a lot of us sort of adapt the money messaging that we were sort of that we grew up in. So it's the money messaging that like our parents adhered to, and we kind of take that into like our adult lives unless we really stop and address it to really understand whether that is the money messaging we want to adhere by and live by. One of my motivations actually to start the podcast was that just in this sort of last year and a half of us being in COVID, especially up here in Canada, and sort of being home and having the opportunity to think a lot more, as you know, you've had less distractions, is I am also an angel investor. I do have written checks at the seed round for multiple tech companies. I did start back in 2014, so I've been at it for, you know, a few years now. And what I found was that anytime sort of, you know, I was getting deal flow or I was having conversations around angel investing, there weren't a lot of females around the table. There definitely wasn't anyone that looked like me around the table, and I'm a woman of color. So my initial thought was like, you know what, I'm just asking for too much. And I think that in itself is really sad that I think that. That I think that it's too much to ask for women of color to be around the table. So I actually wanted to dial it back and be like, why are just like not more females having this conversation? Why are they not looking at it as a investment avenue and an investment vehicle for themselves to generate wealth? And I kind of stopped and took stock of sort of my networks and my life. And I was like, you know what, maybe the problem is me and I'm just in the wrong networks. And I started kind of having conversations with more and more females, even males, to be like, why are there not more females around this table? And I think that the answer I got was like, yeah, like, you know, women don't like talking about money. It's just something that, you know, is uncomfortable for them and it's very taboo. So then what I realized was that I was asking or expecting women to be at sort of step 10 when a lot of them didn't even know where the ladder was. And so there was this massive disconnect. And then I realized that like the podcast was really needed to sort of normalize having these conversations about money and changing the narrative. So yeah, that's a little bit about me. I think I rambled.
So what is sort of step one in this process for you of doing this podcast, conveying the message? What's the first part of the message that you want women, people who have maybe adverse relationships with money, what do you want to say to them?
Yeah, I think that like the first step is to take control of your finances. Because a lot of times with a lot of females that I've also featured on the podcast, because I feature like an array of women, and that's why, you know, it's not one way is the right way, and I'm not trying to say my way is the right way. But I think more and more women need to definitely take control of their finances. I hear way too much and way too often that a lot of females have gone from a household where their fathers were sort of managing their finances, and then they got married and now their husbands are managing it. And that's just a realm of their life that they don't pay attention to. And these are like, you know, very, you know, successful women. And, you know, it's just because their attention is in other places, like whether it's raising a family or their career. But I think that having control of that gives you a level of liberation and also a clearer like understanding of like what your goals are. Are they realistic? Because at the end of the day, money is something that binds us all, right? We're all really collectively out there hustling, going to university to get a degree, to be able to go out into the real world and get a job, and then go and, you know, climb a corporate ladder to enhance our skills to earn more money, whether that's working in a corporate ladder or starting your own business. So I think that really having an understanding of it and having a even high level picture of it is really important. So for me, that's step one.
Just engagement in it, really, is what you're talking about.
Yeah, like take an active role in it and really understand it, right? Like if, I mean, we all look up to people that are super successful, that are not slaves to money, and they're able to, you know, do whatever they want with their time. And one of the common things that I find with all those people is that they have understood how to make money work for them. And I think that this is something that's just not taught to us. And especially women, we're not taught to like to think that way. How do I make money work for me instead of me constantly going out there and just working for money, right? So it's about sort of changing that narrative a little bit as well.
So what made you pursue this line of work?
Yeah, you know what? It's so funny because when I entered university, I never in my wildest dreams would have thought that I would end up in technology. It's just something that I fell into. I started my career working in capital markets on the operations side of things on a fixed income desk at a major bank up here in Canada, and then slowly transitioned. And my advice for sort of young people that are looking to guarantee themselves a job out of university is really sort of going into tech, because that's sort of where the future is, right? And I think I realized that very early on in my career as well, that that's where all the opportunities were. And that's where the high paying sort of jobs were in what I could pursue and what was attainable in terms of my skill set. So yeah, that's sort of how I fell into it.
Where are you from?
I am from Toronto, Ontario in Canada. However, I was not born here. I was born in Calcutta in India, and I have traveled extensively. I've lived in many countries before moving to Canada when I was 16. So I've obviously lived in India in a lot of cities. I left India when I was 5 years old, moved to Singapore, then moved to Dubai, then sort of moved to Muscat in Oman. I've lived in Sofia in Bulgaria, and then sort of moved to Toronto, moved up to Waterloo for school, and then sort of came back to Toronto, met my husband here. And, you know, he's sort of born and raised and is extremely proud Torontonian. So I don't think that we'll be leaving anytime soon.
So are you happy in Toronto? Do you like it as well as other places that you've lived?
Yes, I think that I think Toronto has a lot of value. I do not like the winter. I think our winter season just lasts way too long.
Right.
But I think the multiculturalism of Toronto is something that's amazing. As I mentioned, I am a woman of color. Living in Toronto proper in the city, I don't feel like a visible minority, and that says a lot. So yeah, I think that I definitely enjoy it. I think it's also in terms of opportunity, especially in the tech space, it's becoming a really big tech hub. And yeah, I think it's only going to grow from here.
So what about your childhood? Do you have siblings? What was your childhood like? You obviously moved around a lot.
Yeah, I think that my childhood was probably a lot different than most people that you have on this podcast. I have a younger sister who lives in New York City. She is an attorney in New York. She attended NYU for her undergrad and then Cardozo School of Law as well in New York City for law school. And she's actually married as well. And her husband is also sort of native to New York. So I don't think she'll be leaving anytime soon. And actually, my parents reside in Dubai. So we're a very sort of international family. And I think that one of the benefits of the way that I was raised is that I got to see the world at a very early age and see how different people lived and got to appreciate that. There's definitely pros and cons, but I think that's a huge pro. And I think because of that experience, I feel like I'm able to relate to people from different backgrounds and cultures quite easily. That has, you know, really been beneficial to me.
Hmm. So obviously you work with a lot of people who do have issues with money or problematic relationships with money. Besides the absence of that engagement that you're talking about, what do you see most often?
Some of the themes that have sort of surfaced on my podcast as I've been talking about this topic more is that if money is something and finances is not something that's spoken about in people's homes, the young adults, especially when they move out of their house for the first time, and normally that's going away to university, they're extremely ill prepared for the real world. And specifically when it comes to credit card debt, you know, people sort of apply for their first credit card. No one really explains to them how compounding interest works if you don't pay off your credit card bill in full and if you're only paying the minimum payments. And that's how a lot of young people get trapped in sort of credit card debt. And it's very hard to eradicate when you have developed some bad habits. So I think those are some of the themes that I'm seeing emerging. And I think there definitely needs to be more education around that at an earlier age. I actually don't understand why financial literacy is not taught in high school before people are preparing themselves to sort of move away from their homes, away from their parents for the first time. Because if it's not taught to you and it's not spoken about in your house, then the only way for you to learn is really trial and error. And unfortunately, I think that we're just doing a really big disservice to our younger population and our youth by not educating them about this at a younger age.
Yeah. You know, I grew up in a home where I'm the youngest of eight kids. It just wasn't something we really talked about, you know, much at all. We just kind of knew everything was taken care of, but I think it was considered impolite to talk about money. There's a little bit of that. And, you know, also I think there was a little bit of a scarcity mindset as well. And that's part of the reason why it didn't get discussed, coming from such a big family. But I can see where that's definitely problematic, where, you know, it sets someone up for failure to not have sort of that muscle developed where they have conversations, and conversations like that feel normal and comfortable, you know?
Yeah. And I just want to sort of add to what you just said, Tom, is that I think that, you know, I have interviewed a lot of sort of financial advisors on the podcast as well. And I think some of the themes that they see occurring in sort of the clients that they advise is that they will be some very successful females that are on their sort of roster of clients making well into the six figures, but are still carrying credit card debt. And that is because they have not addressed their relationship with money. They have not addressed their spending patterns and their spending behavior. And even though that they are high income earners, they do not understand why this they just cannot eradicate this debt. And I think that's why it all comes back down to what is your relationship with money, and you really need to address that. And what does money mean to you, right? Like, is it a tool for you? Is it a means of freedom? Like, those are some questions, hard questions you really need to sort of ask yourself to be able to put a plan together for yourself, for your goals, for your future.
Yeah. There's a book that I have a copy of. I haven't read it in its entirety, but it's called Wired for Wealth. Have you heard of it?
No, I have not heard of it.
It's written by these two brothers, Ted Klontz and Brad Klontz. And I'm familiar with them working in the helping profession because they've been associated with this facility in Tennessee called On-Site Workshops, where people go to work on codependency, trauma, that type of stuff. But they also have, I don't know that they're currently doing them, but they also have, I think, probably like 3 to 5 day workshops for people to resolve those kinds of issues that they have with money based on the work of the guys who wrote this book. So, and it's, but it's, they talk, they call it your money script. You know, the story that you tell yourself about money and the beliefs that you have about money that sort of set the tone for the decisions that you make throughout your life around money. You know, I'm an addictions counselor, so, you know, obviously that comes with its whole set of issues around money as well. And compulsive spending is another. You know, a lot of times when people find abstinence, when they get sober or get clean, they then resort to other behaviors to sort of fill the hole. And a lot of times it's compulsive spending.
Yeah. And like, honestly, the flip side of that is sort of, you know, drinking too much. You know, you're dependent on alcohol as, you know, you're using it as a sort of coping mechanism. And if you're sort of in the addiction space, you probably see that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, people do it with spending as well. Definitely. Shopping, spending. And people can also become overly fixated on amassing money. And one of the things, I helped start a facility at one point. Most of my career, I've worked with people of means. You know, the healthcare system in the United States is, you know, as I'm sure you understand, is very much a story of the haves and the have-nots, and it's magnified in addiction treatment because it's really hard to get insurance coverage for it. So the really great providers out there almost just forego even dealing with insurance and only take cash pay clients because, you know, with the reimbursement rates for the services they provide, they're so low that they can't afford, if they took insurance, to provide the quality of care that they need to. So what ends up happening is that people can't really get the good help unless they have the money for it, you know, and it can be, there are programs out there that are $60,000 or $80,000 for 30 days. And one of the things that I learned over the years is that, you know, there's, I kind of had this idea that people who have issues with money are generally people who have issues with not enough money. But what I learned is that to some degree, it doesn't matter where you are socioeconomically. People with means also misuse money. And I've seen an awful lot of parents who sort of sacrifice the quality of their relationship with their children in order to make a lot of money so they can give them the quote unquote life that they deserve. And by the time I encountered these people as their young adults, I mean, they just missed having, they would rather have the time with their dad than have their dad gone all the time making money so that they could have nice things. You know what I mean? So it's really, it also is sort of used as a replacement for love in our culture as well. Have you noticed anything like that in the work that you're doing around this podcast?
I feel like that isn't a theme that has sort of surfaced, but I can totally understand when there's an abundance of wealth, right? It can definitely be a substitute for many things, because then you're in a very privileged place of outsourcing certain things, which is, having sort of nannies and, people are doing your bedtime routine and putting you and giving you a bath. And, I think those are some bonding moments with your kids. So I totally agree with you that, more money sometimes definitely translates into more problems. And as I sort of gave you an example of a lot of females, that are making well into the six figures, still carrying credit card debt, it doesn't mean that if you are just earning more money, all your problems go away. So you really have to, it all comes down to values, right? And what do you value? Do you value time over money? Some people don't. Some people value a certain lifestyle over time. So I think that's the question to ask, is really, what is your value proposition?
And I know for me, watching that happen, what I just described over and over and over again, encountering all these young adults who just wish they had time, more quality time with their parents, and don't know how to relate to them, then becoming a dad myself, it really has influenced my decisions. And I've been intentional about prioritizing time with my son over, like, there are times when I could have had jobs where I would have made substantially more money, but I would have been sacrificing time. And I always chose him over that. That's sort of, a core operating principle for me as a dad, having seen that. And I'm sure, that it's, it is a sacrifice. It's a choice. Definitely. And we have to live with the results of these decisions, right? Whether it's being in debt or being in debt of time or money, it's very much about values. So what does it mean to you, the idea of being authentic as a human being?
Yeah, that's a loaded question.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. It's like, how do you be authentic? I'm like, oh God, like,
I'm interested in your perspective, what that means to you,
Yeah, I think that, being authentic is like really being sort of happy with you, who you are. And whether that is, what you do for work every day, are you making an impact in a way that's meaningful to you? Are you living authentically, true to yourself? And not making compromises and not sort of, I would say, trying to fit into somebody else's box for someone else's happiness or for society's happiness, right? So I think that's a big thing for me about living authentically. And I think that we all realize that as we age. And I think that's something that's a privilege of us aging. We realize that a lot of us maybe spent, like, I know I'm guilty of this. I think early on in my career, probably was definitely doing things because I thought I needed to be doing them. Even, picking a career, going into like finance and starting my career in capital markets, it was, because I thought I needed to be doing that, not really doing the work of sitting down and really asking myself the tough questions of what is going to bring me joy? What is going to get me excited every day when I wake up to do the thing that I'm going to be doing, instead of sort of chasing a paycheck? I think the younger generation coming after us, like, I'm a millennial, And I think millennials as well, like, think that it's less about the money and it's more about what is the impact I'm making in the world? What is, I would say, sort of the legacy that you want to leave behind? And I think that all plays into living an authentic life.
Yeah, I am always inspired by younger generations. I'm not of the mind that, you know, what's the world coming to? Kids these days, you know, like every generation has said since the beginning of time. I think you're right. I think I'm a Generation X guy. And I think all the subsequent generations from mine have all had it a little bit better, or a better mindset, I guess, when it comes to, I guess, authenticity, being real and doing what we really want. I mean, you know, I have a 15-year-old. I don't think he would ever think about doing something with his life because it might be expected of him in terms of societal norms. I just don't think he would ever think of such a thing, nor would he think of judging someone based on the color of their skin or their sexual orientation. You know, I mean, it's I feel like kids are pure. And as the generations sort of go on, they keep getting it closer to right. I think it's cool to watch.
Yeah, 100%, right? Because I think that as every generation comes, like, we become a little bit more accepting of things, and, you know, equality becomes like a really big hot topic. One of the things that I do want to bring up is that based on something that I said earlier, is that I think that for me, feeling that pressure, and as well as I think that a lot of people that in sort of the Toronto and Canadian ecosystem, we are a country made out of immigrants. And so I think children of immigrants are very, very aware of the sacrifices that their parents made to leave their homeland, to come here, specifically in most instances, to give their children a better life than they had, more opportunity than they had. So I think there's this level of guilt that children of immigrants carry where they have to succeed. They have to be successful because they hear it all the time that, you know, their parents made all these sacrifices for them. So I think that, like, generations to come probably have less pressure, especially when you're sort of born and raised here, where there isn't that sense of guilt, where you're more free to think really about what it is that makes you happy. Where do you add value? So I don't know if that makes sense, but I did want to.
No, I think it does. I think it does. And, you know, I mean, obviously the United States is also a nation of immigrants, but I don't think we do a very good job of remembering that a lot of times. And maybe the reason why generations seem to be getting better with this stuff is because, you know, maybe here we're a little further away from that. You know, we're a few generations removed on average, I guess, from that person who's left everything to come here, you know, which is, I mean, I can't even imagine. You know, I lived in the same home my entire life until I was an adult. I never, you know, I couldn't imagine picking up and leaving one side of the world to go somewhere else. And, doing it under duress and then coming to a place where you probably don't speak the language and people then sort of look down upon you as if you're a lesser, you know, it's just, there's so much around it that makes it hard to some degree, just, I would think, traumatic for a family to go through. And then I, you know, I've seen that phenomenon that you're talking about probably more in popular culture than anywhere else, where, you know, the children of immigrants who feel this pressure to be a doctor or an attorney or whatever, because mom and dad did all this so I could have that opportunity to really make a difference in the, you know, I mean, it's, that would be tough growing up that way with that kind of pressure.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, with the advancement sort of technology and just the way that like our world has moved, that idea of the American dream, the Canadian dream of, you know, graduating, going to a good university, getting a degree, maybe getting to just sort of like guarantee, you know, lines you up for like a great job, a great career. You buy the house, you settle in a like very nice neighborhood, your kids go to like, you know, a top school. I think that that idea is outdated. I don't think that that dream exists anymore. And in the same breath, I think it's a lot tougher for kids because there's so many options, right? We're just inundated with options. The amount of careers that you can choose now, it's I think, a double-edged sword where it can be a good thing and it could be a bad thing.
One of the things that worries me is that, you know, with all this technology, we are getting so far from analog, you know, that my son, like the concept of Wi-Fi, you know, he doesn't really get it the way that I get it. You know, this didn't always exist. You know, I mean, it's just expected to have this sort of unlimited access to everything right now, everything on demand, where to me, I wonder sometimes, you know, what would happen if it just all falls apart and suddenly we're not connected anymore? Then what are you going to do? If you don't know how to do anything that doesn't relate to technology or isn't dependent upon technology, then, you know, where are you? How are you going to survive? It's just an interesting world, you know?
I totally agree, you know, because sometimes I feel bad for kids growing up in the society today because they'll never know what it is to feel bored. I feel like kids don't know what boredom is anymore, right? Because there's constant sort of engagement and gratification and, you know, iPad and screen time. Whereas, you know, it just even like I'm going out to like making neighborhood friends, you know, things like that, I find that like kids are missing out on. And even with, you know, the introduction of sort of like Netflix and Prime Video and stuff where there's no commercials, like, you know, some of my like fondest memories was like shows that only came on once a week and you waited all week for that show to air. And then you're like yelling to like your sibling to be like, hurry up, it's back on, like, you know, don't miss anything. And so
I mean, for me, like, as a little kid, I think about the night before Easter they always showed The Wizard of Oz, and every year you kind of waited for that, or the Christmas specials, like the Christmas cartoon specials as kids. Now it's just you press a button and there it is. Yeah, and the stimuli, I think, you know, our brains aren't really designed to handle all that, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that it's generations before us, I don't think we're used to consuming this much information and this much content in one time. And I do think our brains get tired of it, right? Mm-hmm. No wonder there's so much more sort of mental health issues when you're like constantly like online looking at other people's lives and feeling like, oh my God, is that what I'm supposed to be doing? Like, or I'm not leveling up, or I'm not living up to, like, you know, what society's expectations of me are. And I think that all sort of like comes back to your question about living authentically. Like, and I think in today's world, we all want to live authentically, but how do we block out that noise? There is so much noise that we are constantly inundated with. And like, you know, you and I are adults. Like, how do kids these days, like, you know, you're sort of raising a teenager, how do you teach them to block out the noise? You know, like, I think that's the challenge and that's the question.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's a lot. It really is. And, you know, what I was going to say is that I had a guest on a while back who, she's a therapist and she works a lot with sex addiction and pornography addiction. And she talked about, you know, our brains aren't designed to have that much stimuli on demand all the time. That's exactly what we, you know what I mean? It's just so much. and it's destructive. And, you know, I don't know if you know, but I mean, pornography addiction is rampant. It's, you know, it's more and more a problem. And, you know, the generations now, I mean, like if I wanted to access pornography as a kid, I mean, it was a whole thing. Like it was a VHS tape that some kid had at his house and somebody's watching the window for when mom pulls in the driveway. Now it's like, it's all right there on your phone right now. Anything you want. I mean, and it's, the world is different now. I mean, how everything happens in our lives is different now. It's crazy. I'm really glad that I grew up when I did, that I didn't have to deal with social media as a teenager and all this stuff. I just think it would have been really hard, you know?
It's so funny because I'm actually surprised to hear that like pornography addiction is on the rise. And I don't know if you mean within young kids, because I think I was reading something the other day where the younger generation today is having a lot less sex, like teenage pregnancy and teenage sex right now is at sort of an all-time low because people are just addicted to their screens. So yeah. I don't know if for you that's a good thing because you have, you know, a teenage boy at home.
Well, I suppose there is an upside to it too, but the, you know, it's not really age dependent. It's not. I'm good friends with a guy who is the operations director at a program out in Colorado that treats intimacy disorders in men. And when I say intimacy disorders, like sex addiction, pornography addiction, that's how they describe it, as intimacy disorders. And so, you know, that said, I have a friend, like an old childhood friend who was divorced maybe 10 years ago at this point. And, you know, one of these people who I'm kind of like sporadically in contact with. My life has changed a lot. I moved away from there. And, you know, I work in the addiction space. So, you know, bits and pieces over the years, learning what happened, you know, he basically lost his marriage. The pornography addiction is what became the wedge in the relationship, because, you know, it's a way to have a relationship with an apparition, essentially, that satisfies you in a certain way and then enables you to avoid the real sort of substantive relationship with a human being that actually requires accountability. So I know that there are lots and lots of husbands out there who, you know, people get married and the, you know, the cliche idea of people get married, then they stop having sex. I mean, obviously there's a reason why that sort of stereotype came about. But so I think a lot of guys, what they end up doing if they don't have a functional sex life is resort to that. And then it becomes this whole, it becomes a wedge, and then it's addictive. So, you know, an addiction is inherently difficult to stop. So, yeah, I mean, it makes me sad to know that it destroys marriages. It really does. And, you know, I'm not saying this with any judgment about whether it's okay or not, you know, to engage in it. I'm just saying that it interferes. It becomes invasive to real intimate relationships. So, yeah, didn't see us going down this path, Priya, to be honest. I didn't think we'd be talking about pornography addiction, but yeah, it's a big deal. It is. It's more and more, I think, as time goes on, we're going to see the prevalence of it, all age groups. But this is where kids learn about, like I learned in the alley about sex on my way home from school from other kids. You know, that's how I really learned about the birds and the bees. And a lot of kids these days are learning about it from Pornhub. Such a different world.
Yeah, I think that probably this is probably what the education system is doing right, because I think sex education is part of the curriculum. So I think a lot of kids probably already know before that class starts. But if they didn't, then that is a good way to sort of, you know, teach it to you in the right way, in a scientific way, in a structured way, in a safe environment. So I do think that that's really important. I will give kudos to the education system to that is doing that. But yeah, to your point, I think a lot of people learn it sort of through their friends, or, you know, find sort of a magazine sitting around at home, or to your point, like, it's way too easy to find on the internet now, you know, like you're on a site, a gaming site, and some pop-up comes up, and then you're sort of like, hey, what's that? And, you know, inquisitive minds are gonna click on it. So yeah, there's way too many avenues now that the younger generation can tend to. And sometimes that's great, because, you know, it's information is power. And sometimes, you know, it leads down places like, you know, looking at pornography very early and giving you an idea of what sex is supposed to be, which is very unrealistic.
Yeah. And going back to one of the original points that we covered, part of the reason why this dynamic exists is because that's another taboo topic that families don't often talk about. They avoid it, you know? And so it's another one of those things that people go out in the world with a funny relationship with, just like money, right?
100%. 100%. And like, this is a topic that I feel like is like super taboo in like immigrant homes. Mm-hmm. So I think that, yeah, I think, again, it's like, how do you normalize that to be like, no, this is like a part of our life. It will be a part of your life as you grow as an adult. And it's important to talk about, right? And it's important to talk about the safeties of it, the dangers of it. Like, and it's, I think I can draw so many parallels to money. You're totally right.
Now, I got it. Like, have you ever made this correlation before, or is this something we discovered together?
It's definitely something we've discovered together. I've just sort of had an aha moment.
Isn't it interesting?
I did have a personal coach, a personal trainer on my podcast as a guest, and she was just making so many, you know, distinctions and sort of references to how money and budgeting is so similar to, like, you know, fitness goals and your diet and like what goes on, got to track what comes in, what goes out. And it's so similar to food. And like, you know, she was dropping these gems where I'm like, oh my God, I've never thought of it that way. So yeah, I'm having like a flashback moment to that interview right now.
Well, they're all basic human needs. You know, money's a resource. And we need it.
Yeah, 100%. It's so secular.
Yeah. So why is all of this important to you, you think? What part of you, like, deep down, where's the conviction? What's the why?
The why for me is really all about, how do we empower more women to take control of their financial independence? I feel like I've spoken to way too many females on my podcast that have only taken control of their finances once sort of a binary event has occurred in their life. And that binary event normally is a divorce. For them to sort of totally change the direction of their life and how they view finances and money. And I think that's a really unfortunate thing. So how do we empower more women to really think about this at an earlier age? Because, and if they do have an understanding of it at an earlier age, they're going to start building wealth. And the more people that are building wealth, the better off, you know, our society, our economy is going to be. It sort of infiltrates into all aspects. So that's sort of my why is, you know, let's empower more females to make better financial decisions.
Mm. So looking back on your life and what you've experienced, if there was a time when the younger Priya needed some support or a word of advice, when would she have needed it most? And what would you go back and say to her?
Yeah, I think that it would probably be maybe when I was in high school, sort of applying to universities, I think I did it very blindly, just being like, okay, I need to apply to these programs because if I graduate out of these schools and these programs, I'm going to have a great job. Without really doing introspective work, without working with a coach, I think that's super important, or a counselor, a good counselor, to really understand like what my skills were and how could I leverage post-secondary education to enhance those skills. Because I think intrinsically, people that do really well in life or have successful careers is because they're doing something that they love, right? And that they're intrinsically good at. So it doesn't feel like work for them. So I feel like I definitely didn't give that enough thought at that age. And if I could go back in time, I would tell myself, do the work, really, really, really dig deep and figure out what matters to you.
Sounds like pretty good advice. And talk about personal authenticity. I mean, that's really why I wanted to do this podcast, because that's something that I didn't do. I just kind of went along doing what I felt like was kind of expected of me by the people who loved me, the people around me, what would sort of appease everyone. And, you know, pretty quickly found myself miserable. It didn't go well. And so if I can do something to help someone else avoid that and have a happy life, and just like you talked about more people with wealth making it better for all of us, I feel like the more of us who are doing what we actually want to be doing with our time, with our lives, the better off we all are. The world's a better place. Well, listen, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, Tom. This was a riveting conversation. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It was my pleasure.
Authenticity proudly supports the iSpeak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit iSpeakMedia.org. There you go, Priya Veer. You know, it's funny, one of the things I was going to mention at the beginning of this episode, but I forgot, is that one of the ways that I struggle with money is that it's about valuing myself enough. I undercharge, so then I under-earn, so then it's a struggle. And I know deep down it's about self-worth, and I've grown a lot in that area of my life, especially in the last 3 years. But as I record this, I have an appointment in about an hour and a half where I agreed to do some work for someone for literally half of what I want. And there are reasons for that. He's a friend. I want to be able to help him. It's something I'm a little bit new at, something new I'm trying out to earn some money. But still, half? Anyway, hope this has been a good episode for you all. Hope it's been meaningful. Priya's super sweet, professional, together, and she took this seriously. I appreciate that. Anyway, if you enjoy listening to the show, please take the time to leave a rating or a review, especially if you can do it on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. But wherever you listen, whatever they enable you to do in terms of liking, following, leaving ratings, reviews, please do it. Every little bit helps. And if you have questions or comments, you can call 561-247-4757 and leave a voicemail. So I might even use it on air. You never know. One thing I would love to be able to do is have you guys call and pose questions to me. I play the questions, respond at the beginning of the episode. That would be great. I hope you join me on Clubhouse on Friday night, 9 p.m. Eastern. popcorn style, any topic you want, let's talk. For early access to this and every new episode, as well as unedited interviews and supplemental content, you can support the show on Patreon right now for as little as a dollar a month. And just beginning this past week, there are some episodes of the podcast that you can only listen to if you're a supporter on Patreon. So thank you to the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. Thank you to the sponsors, The Manor and Windrose Recovery, Her Escape Vortex. Thank you to Wendy Chin at Equivox. And as always, The Path to Authenticity is proud to support the iSpeak Media Foundation. Media literacy. I actually reached out to someone who works for one of the major networks and recently began a podcast specifically on media literacy. So I'm hoping to get her on the show as well. Visit the show, thepathtoauthenticity.com. You can email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. Facebook, Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. So thanks again to Priya Veer. Thank you all for continuing to come around, continuing to listen. Be nice.
Player.
This episode was brought to you by Equivox. For digital marketing or web design services, visit Equivox.com.